Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another edition of the Berlinale series. So, in this episode, we're going to look at the retrospective and the classics sections in the festival this year. And it's become a very happy pattern for, I guess, now three different festivals talking about the classic selections with KJ Ralph Miller of the Academy Museum. Hello.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, I think this is our third time covering the old movies at festival. Yeah, I'm really happy to be back. Thanks for having me. It's always really fun to go over the selections that maybe aren't on as many radars. Like I keep trying to find coverage online of folks who are really immersing themselves in the retrospective. And there is a great Hyperallergic article that covers the retrospective titles this year, but otherwise it's like scant. It's difficult to find. So I'm glad that we can fill in some of those gaps.
Yeah, me too. And because, also because they do wend their way to show in the rest of the world. And if they don't, all the more reason to talk about them. I understand totally also that people don't always write about them. I mean, in the economy of film journalism, I guess it is marginally more marketable to write about a new Hong Sang-soo versus a restoration or something. But so this was also, I think, just to remind people what that your kind of mission there is to look at these older films especially.
Right. Yeah. So this was the first year that I was able to travel to. Actually, it's my first time in Berlin, period. I just had a festival badge, not a market badge. So I was seeing primarily films with audiences, like with the public.
Oh, great.
And especially in the retrospective, well, for most of the screenings I went to, but especially in the retrospective sections, I was surprised that they were totally packed, like not an empty seat for most of them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's encouraging. I think it means for a lot of the retrospective titles, it was on average an older crowd, also skewed very female, I was noticing, but that might have a lot to do with the selections, which we can talk about later. But for me, I'm there looking for films that might play at the Academy Museum. Our public programs are year-round, and we usually are only focusing on retrospective titles and really trying to boost the opportunities for Los Angeles and North American and world premieres of restorations. And many of these films, with the exception of a few, have never played in Los Angeles, the ones in the retrospective program at Berlin. So it was a really exciting opportunity to dive into some of these, especially the retrospective that is this year entirely from the Deutsche Kinemathek and their collection.
Well, we could start with maybe one that was especially an event, since it was with a live orchestra.
Yeah. So they're kind of retrospective titles, like all the older films in the Berlinale are divided into two categories. So there's the classics section, and classics is entirely world premieres of new restorations. So in that section, we had things like, Scorsese's After Hours, Day of the Locust, Godzilla, like the original 1953 Godzilla, and then two Lubitsch titles, including Cole Heissel's Daughters, which is, I think, the film that you'd like to start us off talking about, which, as you mentioned, was an event in the Berlinale. It was playing at, I think, 11 a.m. on a Saturday at a cultural center that must have had maybe 800 seats, pretty full for an 11 a.m. screening. People were there with their families, and it did seem like a very hometown crowd of locals. And the restoration was presented with a nine-piece ensemble from the Berlin Philharmonic with a new live score that was commissioned for this new restoration. So it was a pretty special, it was the most event feeling thing that I went to outside of a couple of premieres of films in the competition.
You were saying when we were talking beforehand, I mean, I really found it delightful. And it's Lubitsch for one thing, but it also has a star of the time in a double role, which is also pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's the easiest way to describe it is an adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew, but set in the German countryside. And it follows those beats in a familiar way, though the film is broken up into four different acts. I think it's less than 70 minutes long. It's quite short. And the film unfolds with Cole Heisel, sort of a local older gentleman who has two daughters, both of whom are played by the actress Henny Porten. And so she's playing both Gretel, who's the younger daughter who is very, charming and free-spirited and is conventionally attractive. And then there's also Henny is also playing Liesel, the older daughter and sort of the traditional shrew character in Shakespeare's tale, who's very hardworking and just doesn't really have herself put together and is just very rough around the edges. And they all sort of work together on their father's land and farm, but then also help run his inn, which is a communal gathering place for other people in the community. And two men come through town. And of course, the younger, charming Gretel is sort of the object of attention and affection for both of the men. But Cole Heisel sort of makes the determination that, it's going to be easy enough to marry off Gretel. I have to marry off Liesel first. And then thus ensues sort of the regular cadence of the Taming of the Shrew story, but with a lot of like physical comedy and also heart. And the lead, the main male actor is Emil Jannings, who didn't make the best decisions later in life, but in here is just like really captivating and is great with physical comedy. So I don't know, what did you make of it, especially with regard to it being like a Taming of the Shrew adaptation, but in the like snowy German countryside? It was a really interesting visual difference for me.
I mean, it almost became its own thing in a way. I mean, it really is interesting that it is a double role, because it makes it, in a way, a kind of complex performance. I just liked first just the comic setups, no surprise for Lubitsch, having an argument and someone throwing all the stuff out of a room or something. I don't know, even just the staging of that. And then, I mean, Henny Porten in this role, she's funny as both. I mean, the Gretel is also kind of like a bit vain. I mean, the movie basically opens with her emptying this piggy bank so she can buy some, pendant or something from a peddler. And then immediately trying to impress someone, people who are walking by with it. So I think from the beginning, they're not even holding her up as an ideal or like the normal. It's already like a little dubious to want to be like Gretel. Liesel might be an example of like something where I saw like the outlines of like later characters. Like, even though this is like set at a farm and an inn, isn't she also kind of like a lot of later like rom-com characters who, or screwball characters who are like so busy in their work or something, and that they're like barely getting around to
Brushing their hair,
right, yeah,
like
something like that.
the top knot she has in this movie is like a visual gag in and of itself.
Yeah. And I thought she's just really great at, like, again, because it's like a silent movie. There's this whole sequence where she's first serving the two travelers, one of whom who proposes to her, because there's a reason that makes sense, supposedly, as part of this scheme. The way, do you remember the way she just carries in those two beers to them? It's just like she's already had it up to here, because they interrupt their dinner in coming into the front of the inn. I don't know. I just like every little move of hers.
Not just the way she doesn't just carry the beers to them like in a really sloppy way, but when she's pouring them, like she takes the normally you would take like the foam up on the top of the beer and scrape it off. Like there's a little like metal object that you would keep in your kitchen that you scrape the foam off of the top of the beer with, and she uses her finger to do
Yeah.
it. And they're both just like, oh, like the two guys are just so disgusted by this. And she could care less because all she wants to do is just get back to her meal, which she's like, they're eating dumplings. And she, there's also this joke where she like the father has a dumpling in front of him, Gretel has a dumpling in front of her, and Liesel just has like the entire pot with the rest of the dumplings like on her lap, eating it with like the serving spoon. She's just so, she's just no nonsense. And there's many visual gags to be had about that.
Which is funny, because like I guess at the time that would make her, and maybe now too, just the butt of the joke that she's supposed to be this. I keep seeing the word cloddish when I look at her screen. But for me, I don't know. I kind of like, she was just sort of like, she's working, she does that, blah blah blah. Make sure there are enough dumplings when I come back. I don't want to put up with any shit. It's just like, I was like, yeah, well, sure, In spite of what the movie might be, positioning her as, I kind of ended up sympathizing with her more often than not.
Oh, totally. And then I think, you know, when it comes to the character turn that you're sort of expecting from this arc that we know if we know this story, like, because the Taming of the Shrew always sits really grossly with me. Like I kind of
Oh, yeah.
the third act always makes me feel just real bad at like a cellular level. But this film actually, like, even when we come around to that, we kind of it doesn't feel as maybe because it's Lubitsch and it has that like special touch that he gives everything. Like, I wonder if I didn't feel like quite as gross about it at the end because she's such a dynamic character that you know that life is in her, regardless of like how down she's become.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think that's true. I guess later you would call with Lubitsch, you'd call it like a sophistication, but what that also just means is just like a smoothness, a lightness. I guess this was like after having a couple of hits, then this is what he chose to do next.
Because this is after So This Is Paris, right? Which I think is from 1919. So yeah, he makes something that's like very much a hometown story for him, right? Even though it's a period piece. And then there's also, I mean, we should also mention that part of the classic section this year was another Lubitsch restoration of The Love Parade, which is a beloved title. So it was nice to see this kind of deeper cut from the Deutsche Kinemathek as part of this year's selection.
One last thing on it, when I was poking around, I saw Molly Haskell referring to it as possibly the first great screwball comedy.
Oh, I love that.
I liked.
It really is. I mean, it's delightful. Like you had a great time watching it, you know, after the festival on your own, and the added bonus of being in an audience that was really just like really connecting to it. It does feel more, I don't want to say sophisticated, but it feels like it's of another time than the time in which it was actually made, in that like it feels closer to the 30s than maybe like a slapstick comedy. It is more screwball than slapstick, right?
I think so, yeah. Also, just since a lot of it involves kind of you're knowing something that the dramatic irony, you know, you're knowing something that not just like, I mean, someone does fall down a snow slope, but there is that, but it's also other stuff. So we can now leap forward since there was such a span of films that were showing to something from the retrospective program that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to, since we were just talking about, you know, sort of the gender dynamics that are
Yeah.
inherent in Kol Heisel's Daughters, to a film by Elke Sander called The Germans and Their Men, A Report from Bonn from 1989, actually made for German television in 89 and then released theatrically in 1990. And Elke Sander is one of the few filmmakers in the retrospective section, actually, that I came to this collection familiar with for several reasons. I mean, she kind of is known for being one of the most radical, the most vocal feminists from West Germany and from that period. And she's still living today. She was there to introduce the film, but several of her films have gotten recognition, not just at the Berlinale and in Germany and from the Deutsche Kinemathek, but also stateside in the US, especially with her film Reduper's, which is also titled All Around Reduced Personality, which
Yeah.
is a really wild film from the mid-70s that was part of a retrospective at the Berlinale in 2019 that was entirely focused on female filmmakers. So this film, The Germans and Their Men, was not part of that retrospective. And this is kind of part of what I find so admirable about the retrospective section this year, is that it's 25, I think, or 26 films that are exclusively drawn from the Deutsche Kinemathek's collection. Most of them, if not all, have been restored digitally and have not screened either since they premiered at the Berlinale when they were first made, or in a retrospective section since then, right? It's a wonderfully refreshing selection of films that are kind of considered, you know, to be independent, experimental, outside of commercial filmmaking practices from the 60s and into the 1990s. So the retrospective section this year is called An Alternative Cinema. And I think Elke Sander is just like kind of the pinnacle of alternative, and not just like, you know, alternative overall, but alternative feminist cinema from this period. So this film, The Germans and Their Men, is really a remarkable example of not just exploring gender dynamics in kind of contemporary society, but also as a way of exploring just modes of filmmaking that are outside the mainstream and sort of are in an attempt to locate and identify a feminist language for cinema. And I think that her way of approaching this through hybridity, like this film is documentary, but it also is a very set up documentary in that she kind of takes breaks from the moments of dialogue that extend throughout the film to play and to have these fun narrative moments with her lead. So The Germans and Their Men is set in Bonn, and Alcassander has hired an Austrian actress, Renee Felden, to sort of be her proxy in a way, to interact with and invest in the main inquiry of the film, which is really to sort of like top line the inquiry of the film. It is Renee, Helga by way of Renee, asking, do you think being a man is a political problem? And so, so Renee is traveling to Bonn in the hopes of finding a man. And the film starts where, you know, in voiceover, Renee is saying that she wants to find a man who laughs at her jokes, who makes her think creatively, you know, who she can really connect with, who verbatim, like, who isn't just staring at my tits all the time, and is traveling with this handheld suitcase, like through a forest and up onto like a cliff to shout from the top of a bridge and from the top of these rocks, like, where can I find a man? She starts out in Bonn at an airport where she's interviewing business travelers, exclusively men, about why or whether they wear a tie, why a necktie. And the answers are hilarious. They kind of are talking about like the necessity of a tie as a way to indicate status, or the fact that I don't wear a tie when I'm, you know, on my times of leisure, because it makes me, you know, a tie makes me think about work and it makes me think about productivity. And when I'm at leisure, I don't want to think about that. And she even goes into sort of a clothing store to talk to a necktie purveyor about what draws certain men to certain kinds of ties and patterns. And within this, it's always with this air of lightheartedness, even though you can tell that she's ramping up to ask harder questions, right? Just she's really starting with this inquiry about why men wear ties. And someone goes so far as to even say that, like, we all dress the same to subvert the fact that we're all like actually brilliant thinkers or something like that. Like,
what?
This insane proclamation. And then that sort of segues into other segments where Renee is traveling through Bonn, which, by the way, is sort of, it's the dying political center at this time in the late 80s, early 90s of old West Germany, right? So she's kind of slowly making her way into more sort of influential circles to ask more thought-provoking questions. And along the way, she accepts a ride from a cab driver who is sort of telling her where men of different status go to find brothels and to find opportunities to pay for sexual acts while they're visiting on vacation or while they're there, you know, from out of town. And she takes that opportunity of this long drive to find these brothels to ask him why men prefer dating younger women, or why is it that men can be like old and wrinkly and like have a pot belly and still be like desiring younger, you know, the perfect younger women. And this cab driver, like, very frankly, is saying, well, like, yeah, women shouldn't have wrinkles. Like, it's just not attractive. And like his logical fallacies, like, are numerous as he's explaining the reason why there's this imbalance between older men and older women, right? And sort of just underlining the cultural status that an older man has versus the less heightened status that an older woman has as she gets older and as she ages. And I should say Renee Felden is maybe in her late 40s, early 50s, but like is a beautiful, striking figure. And so, of course, these men are like very keen to talk to her, in a lot of cases, flirt with her and like hit on her. And so the film kind of continues in this way to ask more and more probing questions. And ultimately, by the end of the film, she's sitting in with sort of leaders in the more like liberal wings of government asking, whether if women have been so historically disenfranchised when it comes to voting, when it, when it comes to representation by the political system, like, can they actually bear the same burden for Germany's dark history that men should be bearing, right? If they've been so historically disenfranchised. So it's getting into some really heady and really incredible questions about gender dynamics and that imbalance, but also keeps it really lighthearted. Like when I was mentioning earlier, the film starts out with this conversation about ties. She also takes a break to cut away to ties on like a luggage conveyor belt, like moving through security through the airport in kind of this like fun, whimsical pattern as these ties are just going by on this conveyor belt. At another moment, after she's had this dialogue with the cab driver about the sexual currency of an older woman, she goes into a hotel room and sort of dresses up like a young German barmaid, like in this very girly outfit. And you think like, oh God, is she going to go into the streets like that? And she doesn't. She just, kind of has this moment of dress up and play in her hotel room. And really the way that Elke is able to balance comedy with these incredibly serious and like necessary inquiries just makes for such an incredible viewing experience. It was maybe the most elated I felt walking out of a film, just for the freshness of the voice and also the daring of some of the questions she's asking. I mean, when we think about the fact that we've only started grappling with the Me Too movement and gender inequality in a really visible way in the past, less than a decade, right? And this film from the late 80s is also kind of at one point Renee goes to a hotel where she's asking the cooks at the hotel whether they understand that 330,000 women every year are sexually assaulted in Germany. And if you make that number exponential, that means that there are millions of women within a 5-year period who experience sexual assault in Germany, and each of them is denying it, and each of them is refusing to take responsibility on a personal level for that statistic. And when you think about it, the longer this segment goes on, and she doesn't make this explicit, but as a viewer, you kind of realize, like, oh, one of the men that she's speaking to has been someone who's perpetrated sexual assault. Just by the numbers, that has to be the case. So it was an incredibly like moving and energizing experience. And also, she was there to introduce the film, though she was speaking in German. So.
Oh, they didn't have a translation there.
Well, so for each of the retrospective, the only knock I will give to the retrospective section this year, or maybe this is a historical precedent, but they welcome the audience in both English and German, and then they invite the special guest who's there. And for most of the retrospective titles, there was a special guest to join them on stage. And then they say the Q&A will now continue in German, and then it's just in German. And I've heard Elke speak in English. Most of these filmmakers were educated in a state school system that provided them access to both German and English language. So it could have been in English, but I think just for ease and maybe time, they kept it strictly in German. But from what she was saying on stage, the audience was responding with laughter. So even today, I think she has a very lighthearted approach to what are actually like incredibly radical views.
That's what I was going to ask, like how the audience today responded to it, because obviously it's not like this is a time capsule and that this stuff is somehow out of date. I feel like that's also what must be part of what's interesting watching that film, is that it's occurring at such a historic moment where so much has changed and would be about to change and everything, but I'm sure like it's evergreen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that you could make a similar film today and it would feel like, or you could try a similar project today and the outcome would feel quite similar, I think, just with different language and different types of virtue signaling happening, And I think one of the segments in the film that got the loudest reaction from the audience is when she interviews young boys. Like, I'm talking, these boys can't be older than 12 in the most case. And she's like, what do you think, what is the difference between a man and a woman, is the question that she poses to these 8, 9, 10 year olds. And their responses are, not shocking, but shocking. Like not surprising, but still that they're saying, a man goes out to work and the woman stays at home and takes care of the house. Like this is 1989. Like even in a seemingly like liberal area of Germany, this is still kind of the dominant narrative that like women stay at home, men go to work.
This makes me think of one of the newer films, Favoriten, the latest movie from Ruth Beckermann, Austrian director. But I mention it because it's set in an Austrian primary school over a series of years. And I think at one point they are actually asked some question, or that question comes up about roles. And for what it's worth, the answers are a bit better.
It's encouraging.
As of 2020, whatever that is, Vienna Public School or whatever it is. And the teacher, who's this really great teacher, she's constantly, like, gently and not so gently correcting those sorts of answers. Like, well, do you really think that a husband should tell the wife how she's supposed to dress? No, I that's not actually. And she'll just continue until they're like, oh, okay, we understand. It is interesting. I don't know if those lessons were being taught at the same time. I don't know.
And it kind of doesn't go into the education system at all. Like we're really looking at, she does go to meet like members of the press in the film and then like different political and like maybe higher education factions, but the only real sense that we get from the emerging generation, right? So if they're like, they're probably in their mid-40s now or late 40s, and probably in those same seats of power, some of them that we saw sort of fighting against this personal sort of responsibility that Elke is kind of like shoving in their faces, but beneath the guise, I guess, of this very like attractive and like approachable female figure. So yeah, it's interesting. And I didn't get a chance to see Favoriten, but I've heard good things about it.
So the Germans and Their Men, I guess, is the English title, which I also just like the title, which it's almost like, it's almost like the title is the problem of men, like, are they, I guess you were saying it, the question comes up, are they a political problem or something? Which reminds me, do you remember that Agnieszka Holland movie Spore? Did you see that a
Oh,
number of
yes.
years? Where the main character is this kind of natural ecologist rebel figure in the forest, and at one point she basically describes like machismo as a pathology. It's like, yeah, it's something we have to deal with. It's this sort of problem. It's like.
Very similar sentiment in the Germans and Their Men. I mean, she doesn't go so far as to say that, but she does say like she's externalizing a little bit more by saying it's a political problem and not like a psychological one. But she is kind of exposing the roots of the psychological problem in terms of like not being able to get there logically with many of the subjects that she's speaking to.
Well, I hope that we'll get to see that one. It'll make its way beyond the festival. Another movie I think you mentioned, maybe as a highlight or one of the highlights, Herzsprung.
Hairsprung, yeah, which is the name of a town. It's one of the few films in the retrospective that doesn't take place in Berlin. And that's kind of, I think, not intentional, but it's a product of the patterns and sort of history of the Deutsche Kinemathek. So the Kinemathek was founded in 1963. So the 60th anniversary was last year, actually, which is pretty amazing. And that was 2 years after the wall was built between East and West Berlin. And so the Kinemathek was really focused on Berlin stories, like Berlin films made in Berlin about Berlin by filmmakers who were centered there, right? But then there's also this major movement in Hamburg, thanks to a real tradition of theater in the area and also schools in the area, that there were a lot of films by Hamburg-based filmmakers that make their way into the collection. But for most of these films prior to 1989, they are Berlin-based films. And so once we get into the 90s, we kind of break out of that with films like Hairsprung and then another film, Banal Days. But with Hairsprung, we're in this rural setting. And so this film is by Elke Meisselwitz, who was primarily a documentary filmmaker. And if I'm not mistaken, Hairsprung was her first narrative feature. It was a DAFA production, also during this period when DAFA was recognizing that sort of their traditional commercial model of production was falling out of favor and like was kind of maybe not actually doing as well for them. And so they started to take more risks. I think especially after the fall of the wall, they were starting to take more risks by taking on projects that had more sort of, narrative experimentation and were addressing more overtly political and social themes. So this film is sort of a product of that evolution of DAFA. And then it ended up at the Deutsche Kinemathek for that reason, right? That after the fall of the wall in 89, the Kinemathek started to acquire and collect and preserve films that weren't necessarily made as locally. So the main character is a young woman who's working in a kitchen in this rural town of Hersprung. And her father is Jewish, her mother was Jewish, died giving birth to her. And so she's growing up in this small, very removed town with a very small population, but is not, I mean, for very, obvious reasons, not very vocal about her Jewish heritage. She went to school with some boys, and you get the sense that she's maybe a couple years out of school, married quite young, had a child quite young, and then her husband died. And some of her schoolmates who are also still sticking around this town, you get the sense that no one really leaves Hersprung, have evolved to be neo-Nazis. And they're terrorizing this town through not just like, offensive graffiti, but also by just kind of running roughshod over all of the establishments. Anytime they show up anywhere, there's this gang of them that are just like riding motorcycles and these kind of like post-war sort of like tanks or modified war machines. I'm having trouble describing them because I don't know exactly what they were, but like a Jeep sort of, but outfitted like a war machine. And they kind of just are terrorizing and do sort of control this town. And when they recognize that this young woman is of Jewish heritage, they back off, but then they turn their attention to a Black German man who's come to town and is sort of trying to find work there. And this young white Jewish woman is smitten by this very captivating stranger. And it has this sort of Ali Fiery's The Soul adjacent tone and tenor and also rhythm to it that I think is probably intentional. Like Meislevitz was probably inspired by that film, but it's this tragic love story that also sort of stand in for the very fraught sociopolitical times that the film was made in. And the rural setting makes everything that much more sort of charged and heightened in this really fascinating way. And also, I should say, this film is shot in color, and it's, I think, the most visually striking film of the retrospectives that I saw.
Oh, wow. I was pretty curious about them. It's funny you mentioned the visuals just from flipping through the stills. There were a couple of pretty incredible stills on that one.
There's one where she's sort of like twinning with another woman and they're both smoking a cigarette. Her only friend in town is this woman who owns a hair salon, who is a little bit older and just has like, the most incredible like art directed style you can imagine from that like early 90s period, right? She's like sort of punk, but sort of like has this vintage aesthetic. And she gets fed up with the town, especially when the neo-Nazis are really starting to terrorize her and her business. But before she leaves, she trains Joanna to take over the salon. And so that becomes her livelihood for a brief period. But the film is so fraught with racial tension that it's actually, as I was watching it, I was sort of envisioning how or if this could ever play in the United States. I really think that there is an intensity that this film gets at and an unflinching way of looking at the racial tensions between this character, Johanna, and the townspeople that I think without the right context, if shown in a US cinema, I just think that it would really upset people. Like it needs multiple trigger warnings. And I'm not like a trigger warning happy person by any means. Like I think that given the proper like context and the right way of writing a film note, you can set an audience up for what they might expect. But man, in this case, there is just some imagery in this film that Yeah, but in an incredibly powerful way. And again, it's one of the most visually striking things I saw the entire week I was there. There was a retrospective of her work, of Helke Meisselwitz's work at Anthology Film Archives that was a co-presentation with the University of Massachusetts in 2021. And I think it was actually an online retrospective. So maybe it is the case that her films have not come to the US to actually screen like on a cinema in US in any sort of retrospective way. But yeah, there's a video interview with Meisselwitz that you can find online that was organized by the University of Massachusetts from this 2021 retrospective.
That's cool. And they're important to University of Massachusetts, I think, because that's where there's a big DIFA archive, right?
Yes, and scholars who are on faculty who are, I think, are dedicated to the like activation of that archive through their scholarship and through their coursework.
Well, let's see if we can fit in a couple more films.
Yeah.
One more from this retrospective, and then one, I guess, would be from the classics, which kind of, in a way, come together in a neat way. One of them is called Angels of Iron.
Yes, this is a film by Thomas Brasch from 1981 that screened at the Cannes Film Festival, I believe in the competition section when it was first made in 81. It's a black and white period piece set in 48, and this is Brasch's directorial debut. And I think Brasch as a filmmaker is almost as interesting as the film itself. So his backstory is really fascinating. He was born in Britain. He's a German Jewish author, poet, film director. He was born in Britain because he was the son of kinder transport refugees who were also active communists, who then returned to East Germany. And he studied journalism in Leipzig. He worked in the theater. He spent time in the Bertolt Brecht archive in the early 70s, which you see kind of like you see in a way during certain moments in this film that influence. And he only made four features, one of which was for German television. Three of the films that were theatrically released star his wife, Katharina Thalbach, who has been in many films in both German and Hollywood cinema. She made an appearance in Sophie's Choice, for example, but she's this incredibly captivating figure in this film. And they were together until Brasch's death until 2001. So he's just an amazing figure. And I know that there's been some sort of retrospective of his work that's been in focus in the US. So he's not an unknown entity, but this film actually screened when I was at the UCLA Film and Television Archive. We did this cultural trade between the Deutsche Kinemathek and the Film Archive at UCLA, where we sent 10 Los Angeles films from the archive to Berlin, and Berlin sent 10 Berlin-based films to Los Angeles from the Deutsche Kinemathek, and this was one of them.
Oh, cool.
So that was in, oh my gosh, 2017, I think. So this film has been preserved since then and is a beautiful, gorgeous black and white copy of this sort of, based on a true story, dramatic retelling of a figure named Werner Gladau, who during this sort of moment of the Soviet-imposed Berlin blockade of the city's western sectors, just before the end of the blockade, so this year period before this restoration of like law and order, Werner Gladau gathers this gang of thieves to sort of steal from utilities and other government institutions. They sort of loot and thieve these areas for their own personal financial gain because they're sort of the opinion that like it's just chaos right now. So let's just like dive into the chaos. And they're helped along the way by a figure named Volpel, who was a former executioner of Nazi war criminals. And he's now aiding, kind of unwillingly, this unruly gang just because it's advantageous for him at that time to help them out. Because, kind of, one, what else is he doing? And also, he doesn't want to kind of become victim to them. So it's this really fascinating time in Berlin. Also, like there's ruins everywhere, there's rubble everywhere. And it makes for this really fascinating stage where these crimes play out kind of under the watchful eye of no one. Like there's this persistent sort of sound of planes in the air. And there's moments throughout the film where Vopal is looking up to view these planes that are flying overhead and kind of wondering when this is ever going to stop, right? When this airlift is going to be over. And there's just this underlying air of uncertainty and also like lawlessness that this whole film kind of leans into. So it's a really fascinating period piece in this way, but it's kind of asking this question like, what happens when we plan for a future of lawlessness, or we're looking at a future that could contain lawlessness and anarchy, only to find that order is imposed like the next day? Like, what does that say about power? And what happens when chaos is no longer reigning? And also like what it means when your actions have consequences. So I think it's you know, this 30 years on look back at this very uncertain period between two types of law and order. And also just like visually so arresting. And I wouldn't say it's a little bit more romantic than like a social realist perspective, but because of the actual like city in which it's shot, and I have to imagine some of it is restaged, right? But I, as I was watching it, forgot I was watching a period piece multiple times because it just has this, it does have a realism, even if some of the moments that we're looking at can be a bit stagey or exaggerated. It's really rooted in a fascinating reality.
Yeah, it's from 1980 and it's set in like I guess 1948, so that's 32 years, but we're further away from 1980 now
Right.
than they were from the blockade era there. Yeah, I'm sure there must have been still buildings that were in rubble or something.
I don't know again how much of that was staged or set decorated.
Right.
Unfortunately, the filmmaker is no longer with us, but his widow is. So I wonder if there are, and there are a couple of documentaries about Thomas Brauch and some literature. He actually published a lot and translated a lot too, but many of his works that he wrote in German have not been published. So I'm really excited to learn more about him and see more of his films actually, because as a directorial debut, this is so confident and really kind of singular in terms of a way of looking back on this period of history. But actually, this is just making me think of, do you know this film, The Nasty Girl? I think from the early 90s.
Yeah, I know it. I don't remember, but I remember it was kind of a big thing as an art house film. I feel like it might have been nominated for an Oscar or something, possibly. I'm not sure.
I think you're right. And I watched it in, could it have been a New Waves class? I don't remember. I think it was maybe like a contemporary, quote unquote, cinema class in undergrad. I saw that film, and there's still, I remember that's kind of taking place outside of a major city, but they're kind of moving around ruins in that film as well. And that was made in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, and most of the buildings in Berlin seem like there was a big boom in building, I think, in the 80s, 90s. And many of the buildings seem like they're from that era, you know, erasing over history to put like steel and concrete in its place.
Wow, another movie I really hope I can see. So yeah, Angels of Iron. So I did see, just so listeners know that I'm pulling my own weight a little bit at least. I did manage to catch up with another one of the movies that was shown actually in the classics section, and which you two can watch because we belatedly discovered that it's on the Criterion Channel, and that's Depressa, Carlos Saura, 1981. So it's about, I guess it's supposed to be about, in a way, like delinquents, late adolescence or early 20s, but it's basically a small gang of guys in Madrid who are committing crimes that they seem to be pretty good at for most of the movie or much of the movie. It just seems to be their profession, which is kind of funny because somehow I was expecting that they wouldn't be especially good at it and that they would be somehow struggling, but they're actually just kind of they do all right. Then one guy brings into the gang a woman who works at like a little cafe or something, and there's little controversy about that, but then she becomes just as good, if not better than they are, at like gun toting and burglary and bank robbery, and just sort of follows that to its maybe inevitable conclusion. And it's considered part of the cine kinky
Yeah, I think it is.
About these kind of marginal figures.
Yeah, the film premiered at the Berlinale at the 31st Berlinale and won the Golden Bear.
Yes.
It's just so fascinating to think back, 42 years to like it makes me want to understand what the entire competition was and like what this film was up against because it seems extremely accessible, even though at the time of its release, it was actually kind of controversial, I think, because these delinquents that are being depicted on screen are depicted by non-professional actors.
Yeah.
They're so captivating and they're also like extremely unlikely leads. Like just the way that they're like a lot of them have like acne and they're like they have like bad haircuts and they look like they're wearing the clothes that they actually own in real life. I mean
Yeah.
it's kind of like this social realistic authenticity that's just off the charts. So to think about this as the Golden Bear winner in 1981 is pretty fascinating because it doesn't seem necessarily like it's treading any new territory, except maybe in the social realistic aspect and the fact that the film was made sort of right on the edge of Spain kind of transitioning into being a democracy. So, in that way, it is quite similar to Angels of Iron in that you have this. Moment of lawlessness before law and order is really able to restore itself, and a moment where, especially the youth culture, is sort of like, well, I can get away with this without any consequences. And as you said, like, whether or not they're good at what they're doing, they're definitely getting away with it. I mean, yeah, they're like living great. They're paying to borrow horses from a friend and then like taking them into a field and snorting heroin on like, who knows, a Wednesday afternoon. Like, it's just all very, in a way, it's not over glamorizing it, but they are living their best lives. I mean, obviously, with, the pending doom and the pending like fate that is in store for them, right?
Yeah.
Just given the very like obvious influences that this film probably took from films like Bonnie and Clyde or Badlands. I was thinking a lot about Badlands, especially when Pablo is teaching Angela how to shoot a gun, because they're just so young and she's especially so innocent. And her fall from innocence is so swift. And as you mentioned, like she's maybe even more motivated to continue committing these crimes than they are. And she's a better shot than any of them in that she can like wield a gun better than any of them. And she also is so committed to her role that she puts on a fake mustache with spirit gum every time that they go out to commit a robbery or a crime, tucks her hair under a hood in a sweatshirt. And then by the end of the film, the last crime that you see them commit, which is ultimately the final sort of act on this crime spree that they're on, she's also like, with a stipple brush, putting on like a 5 o'clock shadow,
Yeah.
like fully committed to this character. And yeah, I mean, I just think everything from the way that the criminals are styled to the details of their character, each of their individual characters, right? Like one of them is like a pyromaniac, like just at the end of each of their crimes insists on lighting the car on fire and
Yeah.
everyone else is okay with it because he likes doing it. And it's like that's the thrill of the crime for him is the ultimate act of lighting the car on fire, watch it explode.
Yeah.
All of that just make the film inhabit this really captivating space, especially for a genre film. Like it doesn't feel, definitely feels genre. It doesn't feel, I don't know, like exploitation fair, although I understand the themes are exploitation adjacent. I wonder how you felt about that, because I know that the like cine kinky is sort of known as being like, yes, genre, but maybe a little bit more in the exploitation realm. And this felt more like Panic at Needle Park, I don't know, than an exploitation film to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree because it just feels so matter of fact, I mean, the way it just goes. I mean, when they are snorting heroin, it's not like a big production, honestly. I mean,
Yeah.
that kind of sequence has become so fetishized since then. You know, it can't happen without, like, a whole camera sequence or something, close up or something like that. I mean, it was funny to me because I kept on thinking, like, are they, they're not supposed to be cool, but in a way they're cool because it's so casual, but in a way they're not. It's just interesting. It made me think about a lot of the codes and conditioning we have when we're watching screen criminals in action and what they're do when we're being cued to what they're doing being like transgressive or not. And, from the outset, it's set up as like very much like a, they are some sort of scourge on society. And the first thing they do is they hotwire a car. And I guess that scene is supposed to be shocking. And it is to a certain extent, because the very bourgeois, like, owner of the car and his wife, he's got like this blazer he's wearing, and he comes over and starts yelling at them in his own car. But they just sit there and, completely unbothered, because I guess they know that the guy would never actually break the glass or do anything to actually call them on what they're doing. And then they're just able to drive away with it. So I guess that scene is kind of shocking in an almost like old-fashioned way, because it's like, oh my God, can you believe these criminals will do something in broad daylight and they'll flout you to your face? But honestly, that sort of transgression isn't really highlighted later on. They just do the things.
No, I mean, and when you were talking about like the sort of cinematic tropes or like stylings that we're used to when we see a drug sequence, like the first thing I thought of was Scarface, or like a or you know, which is only 2 years after this movie, and or like the Safdie brothers, right? Like, which I'm and no knock against them. I really love something like Heaven Knows What or films that have depictions of drug use and kind of the psychedelic experience that that can be or not, the like really harsh and dramatic experience that can be. But this film does approach that very matter-of-factly, which I agree with you in and of itself is sort of shocking because it's not telegraphing through cinematic conventions like you should be shocked by this. It's really more about the casualness of it. And but there's also like a lot of really lovely moments of dance in the film and moments of like kind of depressive dance, like the scene where she's in a discotheque in what must be the daytime, and she's watching four other women. Angela is watching four other women who are roughly her age, kind of really awkwardly dancing, but like kind of enjoying themselves. And she joins them, but there she does not crack a smile or show any sense of joy. And that kind of is juxtaposed with like the moments of celebration that they have after they've committed a crime or, you know, are kind of like reveling in their earnings or like the aftermath of the crime. There's dance that comes into it in a way that also makes music really important in this film. And I don't know if you what you thought about the use of music specifically. It's and I like Shazammed the music. So I was so into it. And it's by a Spanish Romani rumbia flamenco band called Los Chonguitos. And there are two songs that repeat like several times in the film that are both diegetic, but also like maybe not.
No, I thought that was really interesting. It's almost like it becomes his theme song. The main guy, he has a tape, and they're all actually sick of him for playing this tape over and over again. Because like they do a job, and then he plays the tape. So it is kind of partly just routine, and that's what I mean. Like, also, are they cool or are they kind of dorky? Just like he just plays the same tape. But I don't literally mean that. I think they are kind of cool. But anyway, but they play this song over and over again, so it becomes like almost like a theme song. And there are a couple moments where you think it's playing on the soundtrack, but then you realize it's actually, yeah, diegetic. But also, just I love that you point out the dance sequences, because those were interesting too. I think there are two or three visits, disco scenes, where they start out in this incredible way, which, I mean, does kind of have the feeling of, because for me, this is a movie that's like constantly like oscillating between like being in the moment with these adolescent criminals and being the whatever he was, like middle-aged director looking at them. And the disco scenes are kind of on the knife's edge for that, because on the one hand, they're like really kind of amazing. Like there's something out of like a Bertrand Bonello movie where he starts the disco scene by just panning across them. He's clearly fascinated by the fact that people go to a disco to watch other people dance. You know, and they're just slumped in these
The
like
number
bank hats.
yeah like passing a joint around like super joylessly.
But yeah, anyway, they're playing like these kind of disco standards, kind of in those scenes. So that's distinct from like the music that they're playing for their theme songs. But yeah, the music is really interesting. Something else I wanted to just mention. Oh, you mentioned the character who wears a fake mustache.
Angela.
Yeah, I was trying to find more about the actress, and you said they're non-professionals. It doesn't seem like she has a credit after this, which is completely fascinating. There's like an official like Berlinale picture of her with the director at the press conference at the time or something. But after that, it's not clear what she did or what on screen at least, or what even happened to her.
Yeah, and I think that's the case for a lot of the primary cast and the gang is sort of a gang of four. And I think it's Mecca, the guy who is also a pyromaniac and just like his thrill is watching the cars explode. I think the figure who played Mecca was also a literal juvenile delinquent who was on day leave from prison when he was shooting his parts,
Oh, wow.
which also was part of the controversy because like the casual drug use, the like almost not glorified drug use, right, that we were kind of talking about, and then the fact that these characters are like maybe providing negative role models for society or whatever, like conservative critics of the film were trying to say about it to censor it and not play it in certain territories. Carlos Saura was like, well, actually, yeah, I mean, but this guy is actually a delinquent. Like, this isn't like I'm not exposing these kids to anything that they don't already know in their daily lives. Like, and actually, like, this is social realism at its best in a way that we're using stories adjacent to what these performers have experienced.
And I mean, there are interesting moments where it does kind of blur how delinquent they are, because there's this one scene where they're looking at this Madrid from, I guess, a bit on the outskirts, and there's like this monologue where some guy's imagining some dowdy, working man coming home and having an argument with his wife and his kids and something, and how lame that must all be. But then at other instances, like, the couple is like wondering whether they should buy another house. He doesn't want to, but she does. And then I couldn't tell if it was a joke, but I think it's the arsonist guy is like, they ask him, "What are you gonna do with your money?" And he's like, "Well, this is for the house, this is for the kids." I couldn't tell if that was a joke or not, to be honest.
I couldn't either, but I think that there is some at least like thought toward the future while they are living in the moment and very much enjoying this sort of freedom that they're experiencing from this period of lawlessness and like disorder. There's a meeting that they have. They go to a statue, right, that also is kind of become ruins because it's riddled with bullet holes. And they get stopped by authorities and asked for their papers. And they end up kind of coming out of that experience okay. But they do at least have in the back of their minds, I think, some idea that like there will be a future for them. Maybe Pablo doesn't, and that kind of is indicative in the way that he's living his life. But they're also talking about always a lot. Like that word comes up. It comes up twice, actually, or in two different contexts. So Angela and Pablo, when they first meet, like right before I think they, have sex for the first time, they say to each other, like, will you be with me forever? Yes, I'll be with you forever, for always, for always. Later, after they commit their first successful sort of robbery together, they're gathered on a table, I think in that same scene where they're counting out the money, and they're toasting each other and they say, friends for always, like friends for always. And so I think that they are thinking about the future, but like, what does always mean to, an early 20-year-old? What does always mean to a teenager? Like, I think always means right now, it means like a very short period of time in which they've experienced life. So always for them could also mean now.
No, and I was reading Sara saying that he very much considered them kind of romantic figures. So I mean, in that sense, a kind of flame out is already in the cards, no matter what they're planning. Oh, and I just want to also just flag, I thought the filmmaking was like pretty robust. Like, I mean, these are pretty good like robbery scenes, They're just like these like nice brawny like tracking shots or like swivels and stuff that are just, I don't know, that they get at the suspense of the moment.
I agree. Even when we zoom out from sort of the relationship aspects of the film, right, with either within the gang or within this couple, there's this continuing motif of a train moving through the, you know, tenement housing where they're living that really indicates too, like, so much about that place and about those individuals in that place, right? So like you see this train moving through, and there's various shots, like various setups with the camera of how we're seeing this train move through that all really underscore and emphasize that they're just being passed by. Like, I don't think they live close enough to actually get on that train without walking a great distance. And there's no stop for this suburb. And I think that that as like a visual symbol is also really powerful and thoughtful.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking, you know, you mentioned Scarface being like a year or two around it. I also thought of Almodovar
Oh, yeah.
and his first feature, the Pepe Lucibom.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I guess, was the year before this. And, you know, at that point, he's like a 30, 31-year-old director. And I feel like putting those two films side by side are so interesting, thinking about what they're doing and trying to capture, you know, some alternate realities, some marginal reality. And also, yeah, as you were saying, with the lingering violence in the air of the not so recently ended dictatorship. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Saura was like had a pretty established career before he made this film, right? Like, this is not, this is maybe halfway through his filmmaking career, if I'm not mistaken. Whereas you're so right, like that Almodovar is kind of, I don't know, exploring similar thematics so early in his career. I mean, Almodovar is so distinct and like set apart from not just his contemporaries, but also like his like local contemporaries, right? Like his Spanish contemporaries, but also just worldwide. He's so distinct that, yeah, that is a really interesting comparison. And I think like Saura is not, he's not someone who I'm very familiar with, especially compared to someone like Buñuel or Almodovar. So I also don't know how, you know, maybe you know more than I do, like how experienced with genre he was.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. But as a way of evading the question, I was curious. I was just tapping away here because, you know, you were wondering what else was in competition.
Yeah.
Pull up just the wiki page, and it's pretty interesting. I mean, like how there are all these filmmakers that really haven't persisted too much during this time, but also showing in that year were films by Mrinal Sen, so obviously, you know, still a huge figure. Agnieszka Holland actually had a fever that year, and then Seijin Suzuki.
Wow.
Had Zig and Revisen. Yeah, I mean, those are sort of the more recognizable figures. So just maybe it's a sense of like a kind of shifting of generations where you have a number of, you know, people who are vying, but I don't know. It's sort of, oh, okay. Out of competition that year were Ordinary People and Raging Bull.
Raging Bull, yeah. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
And also like thinking about who was on the jury and,
mm.
But yeah, I mean, it definitely, De Prisa made me want to dig more into Carlos Saura's career. And I don't know what context this is on the Criterion Channel, if it's like part of a collection or what.
I know. I wasn't sure. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's pretty cool. So at least listeners have a chance to see that of all the things that we've discussed.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I guess everyone knows like Cría Cuervos. That's what I know. And I think I even maybe had to review one of his very late films at some point.
Oh, well, it's a whole directed by Carlos Saura channel or collection, I should say. Oh. The cover of which is a photo of Geraldine Chaplin, who I think he made. I mean, they were together for at least a decade and a half, and they made films together. And early, speaking of Almodovar, I know Antonio Banderas was a major collaborator of Saura's early in his life too. So there are 13 films by him on the Criterion Channel right now that folks can dive into.
Wow, that's cool. I didn't realize that. All right. Well,
we covered a lot, and a lot of
did.
It was a bit dark, especially in the middle there. But I think that kind of is expected from this period of German cinema that's, you know, explicitly trying to think outside the mainstream and is experimenting with filmmaking tactics and styles and approaches coming from a place of like being politically unconventional as well. Sort of revolutionary cinematic language and also like messaging within a lot of these films leads to things not being exactly like, lighthearted.
I think that's true. And yeah, I'm really glad that I could hear about all of these. Did you want to mention anything that's coming up at the museum or?
Yeah, we're actually looking at something that New York audiences might be primed to just be thinking about because I know the Film Forum just did their Safarama program that's looking at like lesbian stories throughout the history of cinema. So we're actually doing a similar concept, really, where we're turning a sapphic lens on early Hollywood. So that should be really fun. We're looking at a period of time where Alina Nazimova was sort of inviting women who were bi-curious and maybe explicitly bisexual or lesbian into the safe space of her home to kind of have a community that she called the Sewing Circle. So we're doing this series called The Sewing Circle that should be really cool. And then otherwise, I'm just looking ahead to December when we do our restoration, quote unquote, festival in the winter that's hopefully going to be bringing some of the films that I saw in Berlin to Los Angeles for the first time, or at least the first time these restorations have played in the city. So I'm really looking forward to putting that together in the coming weeks.
That's great.
I mean, this is always so fun. Thank you.
Yeah, and I hope I can corral you again for Cannes Classics later
Ooh,
on.
yeah. I will be there and I will be celebrating a milestone birthday while I'm there. So I'm going to
Oh.
be trying to extend my stay as much as possible in the French Riviera.
Well, that sounds terrific.
But
All
yeah,
right.
I'll see you in France.
Okay, I'll see you in France. Thanks so much, KJ.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.